You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 236. Writing is painting of the voice. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, guys, today we have on the show Naomi Betty. And Naomi has written a new book about how to outline your screenplay. It's something so important in regards to structure, in regards to character, in regards to theme, in regards to plot, and so much more. But her new book is a workbook where you can literally write in the book and outline your script as you're going through it. It really opens up a lot of creativity. It doesn't stifle it like so many screenwriters think that it's going to stop your creativity if you've got it all structured out. You absolutely need to, and you're going to hear all about it in this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Naomi Betty. I'd like to welcome back to the show, returning champion, Naomi Betty. How you doing, Naomi?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. You have a new book. Hold on. Let me just lift it over here. It's the Screenwriting Outline Workbook. It's really not that big, guys. I'm just making it. But it's fast. It's a really great, you know, as I was going through it, it's really cool. It has some really great guidances on how to put together a screenplay, which is not, there's not a lot of this yet in the marketplace. I haven't seen a lot of this kind of, I mean, there's a couple screenwriting books, not too many.
there's a few.
There's a few, but I haven't seen anything like this before. So we're going to kind of dive into the book and what you're doing in it. But first, can you give everybody a little update on who you are, if the case they haven't heard the first episode?
Yeah. Well, sure. The first episode was years ago. So much has changed since then. Yeah. I'm pretty much still the same, though, still doing the same thing. So I'm a screenwriting teacher and script consultant. I work with writers, also, you know, directors and producers one-on-one on their projects, giving them feedback on at the script level and sometimes even starting earlier than that, helping them develop ideas so that they can get the script written. But yeah, basically just working with anyone who has a movie idea to kind of get that idea, you know, into screenplay form and hopefully in good shape so they can start showing it to people.
Very good. So first question.
Yeah.
What is a screenplay outline? Because I like, how do you go about it? What is it? How do you put it together?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question because I think a lot of people set out to write a screenplay and they decide they need to outline it. And then they quickly come to the next question, which is what is an outline? and I think, you know, when it comes to outlining your screenplay, I just think of outlining as part of the pre-writing process. So it's just part of the process that helps you develop your idea and flesh it out and get it to a point where you know enough about it in order to write screenplay pages. And whatever form that takes, you know, what it looks like on the page in the outline form can be a lot of different things. It's what is the most useful to you. So a screenplay outline is really a tool for you to use sort of on the, you know, on the path toward getting your screenplay written. For most people, it's, you know, a numbered list of scenes or a bullet point list of scenes or beats, you know, plot beats that just sort of take you from page one to the end so that you have sort of a map to help you write the actual screenplay itself.
So the next statement I have is what I always hear from people, especially young screenwriters. They say,
But outlining takes all the creativity out of it. It's so, so structured and formulaic. And I don't want to be Hollywood. I want to be free flow. I want to be like Quentin. I just want to jump back and forth and this and that. And I always tell him, I hate to tell you, but Quentin uses structure. And yeah. Pulp Fiction, very structured, and actually goes through the beats of, which is why that script is so genius.
Yeah.
It actually goes through all the beats, but in different timelines. And it makes the head hurt reading that script and trying to break that script down. But that's a master, and that's what he does. So what's your answer to people who say that this just takes all the creativity out of it?
Yeah, I've heard that too. And I understand that concern, right? Because it sort of feels like if I do all of the creative thinking in the outline form and get everything figured out and written down before I get to writing screenplay pages, then I'm not going to have anything left. When I get to the pages, I'm going to be bored by my own story and just, you know, transcribing it from outline to screenplay page. And I understand that concern, but I wholeheartedly disagree with it. And, you know, every writer is different and everyone has their own unique sort of process and way of fleshing out an idea. However, I think that the outlining process can actually be a really creative part of the process, right? Like, why do you think that just because you're putting your creativity into the outline, does that mean that there's not going to be any creativity left in your screenplay, right? You're actually doing a lot of that creative heavy lifting when you're thinking about, well, how do I structure this? How do I develop the character arc? How do I, you know, make sure the relationships are sort of developed all the way from beginning to end, and they're seamless and they have a function and a, you know, an emotion to them and all of that stuff. So I think you can do a lot of that while you're in the outline phase, so that by the time you get to writing screenplay pages, it's not that you've beaten a dead horse and you've, you know, sort of taken all the fun out of it for yourself. You've done so much of the heavy lifting and put a lot of creativity in at that phase, that when you get to writing scenes, you get to have a lot of fun with what happens in a scene, right? Like, how does that come to life? What's the most entertaining, interesting way for that thing that you figured out that needs to happen, right? You figured that out in the screenplay outline. What's the most interesting cinematic way for that to play out, you know, in your screenplay pages and then in the mind's eye, right? So I think that you can be creative and at every step.
So in other words, like, so the structure, literally you're basically beating it out or putting the points of things that have to happen in each scene. So it's like, okay, John has to hit Joe in this scene because this is the catalyst for this part of the story. Now, how that breaks down in that scene is completely up to you. You can make it really fun. At the end of the day, he has to get from point A to point B. How you get between point A and point B is completely up to you. And that's part of the creative process, but at least you have something to start with, as opposed to a lot of writers, including myself, when I first started, just like, I'm just going to start and see what happens and just let it flow. And it's just a hot mess. It's a hot mess because you don't know where you're going. And I also don't have at that stage in my career, I didn't have the craft built up. I mean, if Eric Roth wants to sit down and start writing from scratch without an outline, I'm going to say it's going to be better than most.
Right.
You know, but you have to build up that craft. And I think the structure is so needed. And you can't build a house without a foundation, without structure.
Right. And you make a really good point, because I think, like, you know, Eric Roth, Aaron Sorkin, if those guys at that caliber, if they sit down to write a screenplay, they've done this for so long and have such an innate sense of, like, how a screenplay works, not just story structure, because I think all of us have a little bit of that innate sense of story structure, but they've got it, like, ingrained. They know story structure in screenplay form and sort of what needs to happen page by page on a screenplay, how the rhythm is, you know, how characters develop, where you see complications and things like that. Those guys could probably sit down and write a pretty good draft without doing an outline first. But for a lot of us, and for most of us, I think, you know, there are so many things that you have to remember when you're writing a good screenplay, if you're trying to write a good screenplay, so many skill sets, right? And so I think thinking through the plot and character development in the outline phase actually takes some of the pressure off of you. It allows you to kind of, you know, pay attention to certain skill sets at this point in time. And then when you get to screenplay pages, you can pay attention to other skill sets. You can think about dialogue and scene description and, you know, getting in the scene late and getting out early and
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, thinking in visuals, like cinematic stuff, right? To make it appealing in terms of being a movie. So you have so many skill sets to worry about. I think that, you know, giving some of them your attention in different phases will only help you end up with a better product, you know?
Mm-hmm, without question. Now, so many times we want to figure out what the ideas are. Do you have any idea generating, you know, you know, ways to generate some ideas about scenes, about the ideas, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I do have a couple. I mean, thank you for teeing me up. I do have a couple of exercises in the book that are all about generating concepts for screenplays, right? Because it seems like people who get stuck at sort of the idea phase when they can't decide how to move forward with one project, they have like, they get stuck in two different ways. One, it's either they have too many ideas and they don't know which one to do first or to work on first. And then the other thing is like, I don't know, I want to write a screenplay, but I don't have an idea for a movie, right? So one of the things that I put in the book was a couple of exercises that can help you generate concepts by, you know, sort of playing games, because I think that's the most low pressure way to do it is treat it like a game and just have fun with it. So there are a couple in there about like mixing and matching, you know, different elements and kind of generating concepts. And I think, you know, an important part of it is just generating a lot of ideas, because that's the only way you're not going to get precious about the one idea that you're sure is an Oscar winner and it's going to be $1 million spec sale. If you have lots of ideas, then you can kind of be a little bit more, you know, gracious with yourself about like, you know what, maybe that one's not going to work this year because I don't have the craft yet. Or maybe that's not such a great idea after all. It's better as a novel or a comic book or something like that. And you can, you know, allow yourself to be a little bit more choosy about which screenplays you're going to write.
Now, I after talking to so many screenwriters over the years, off air and on, I love the off air ones because that's when I really get some nitty gritty stuff that I can't broadcast, unfortunately. But I've been told by many of these top screenwriters that they borrow structure from other movies. Wholeheartedly. Like, you know, I saw this movie and I took its structure, changed the story around and changed the ideas around, but, and the characters around, but the structure is there. And I always love using this example because it's so blatant. And after I tell this, most people go, I can't believe I never saw that before. Fast and Furious is Point Break.
Yeah.
They didn't even try to change it. They just changed surfing to race cars and a couple of other characters. I mean, it's pretty much the same movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have actually not done like a side-by-side comparison, but I think that'd be really interesting to do because the broad strokes of it for sure are, it's the same, you know.
It's the same story. So that's another thing for screenwriters, you know, starting up to look at other movies that they might admire and start with those structures. I think that's one thing that's always been, a lot of people think is taboo, but all the greats start with other people's, all artists start with other people's ideas and try to emulate other people's ideas. Yeah. And then as you start working through it, then you start coming up with your own style. But structure is structure. I mean, it's like, why wouldn't you take a blueprint of a house that worked and worked well and then dress it up however you want to dress it up and change the walls, you know, add a door here, put a door there, change the roof side, style. But at the end of the day, it's a structure that sells. Does that make sense?
I totally agree. And I always tell writers, especially, you know, writers who are trying to get a handle on screenwriting, right, who are kind of early in their learning curve, I always tell them to study movies. And, you know, I think we all probably watch a lot of movies, but I do think it's a helpful exercise to like choose one or two and really break those particular movies down and study them, because I think you learn a lot from not just viewing it once or twice, or even if it's one of your favorite movies and you've seen it a lot and you can quote it and all that stuff. But if you really like take the time to sort of examine it, almost like a, you know, doctor patient kind of exam, like make a list of all the scenes that happen, look at that list and examine like, where does the inciting incident happen? Where does the break into act two happen? Notice the relationships between those two plot points, right? Because they have to work together in a particular way. Look at that midpoint and see, how does this midpoint work? Like, what does it do for the story? How does it, you know, make things harder or make things more urgent? examine all of those big turning points, because I think you learn a ton from not just understanding theory and understanding like the definitions of plot points and things like that, but really looking at the way that they work in movies, and especially in one particular movie. And I think that an extension of that exercise, if I can just keep going here, is that paying attention to the difference between, just like we were talking about, like when you make a screenplay outline, right? You might have a bullet point list of here are the things that need to happen, just point by point. Joe needs to punch Tom, right? That's one bullet point. And the next one, something else happens. But making that bullet point list for the movie that you're studying, because then you get to see, oh, here's what happens. Joe punches Tom, but here's how it happens in that scene. Like, it's funny, or it's a, you know, it's an ambush, or it's a, it starts out a romantic scene and it ends in a punch. How does that happen? Right? Because you get to like really understand there's a difference between the what is happening, the plot thing that's happening, and the cool, interesting, fun way that that can play out on screen, which can be a million different ways. And, you know, you're saying structure is the same from, you know, across sort of lots of movies, right? That's true. And then the how it happens on screen is what makes it uniquely entertaining. You know, it's what makes one movie different from the other one.
It's the color of the walls. It's the dressings. Yeah. It's the furniture in the room. It's the, you know, if we're using the analogy of a blueprint in a house, all of that makes a difference, you know?
Yeah.
It's all about how you add the little details to it.
Yeah.
You know, there is, you know, when we are looking at a movie, sometimes we don't know whose story it is, especially when we're starting to write a movie. We don't know whose story it is. So I always like using Shawshank as an example, because everyone knows it by nausea now that Shawshank's my favorite movie of all time. And I've asked a lot of, you know, experts like yourself, like, whose story is it? Is it Andy's story or is it Red's story? Who is the protagonist in that movie? You know, whose story is it? So that's a very important distinction to have when writing, because if you don't know whose story it is, you know, whose story is Fight Club?
Right.
Is it Tyler Durden's story?
Yeah. I actually had just another example kind of in the same vein come to me yesterday. I rewatched Fargo. I hadn't seen that movie since I originally watched it back in like 96 or whenever it came out.
Right.
In my head, in those intervening years, I believed that that was Marge Gunderson's movie, right? Yeah. And I rewatched it and I was like, oh no, I was completely misremembering this. This is, now I'm totally blanking on his name, but it's the husband. Oh. Yeah. He's the lead character. He's the central character in that story. We start with him. We're watching what he's doing. It's his actions that are driving the story forward. She comes in like 35 minutes in to investigate, you know, what he's been doing, but we're with him from the beginning. I was like, that is so interesting that I remembered it being her story, I think, because I assumed the investigator on the scene is going to be the one kind of driving the story forward, but it's actually his story.
You start getting into a complex conversation about something like Shawshank, because I mean, who drives the story is Andy.
Right.
But yet who's telling us the story is Red. So we're seeing the story through Red's eyes. And yeah, Red does do a few things to help along the way, but Andy's the one driving the story.
Right.
You know, and also their interaction is driving the story. So it's a very complex idea. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. And same with Fargo. I think that even though I'm sort of like saying that so easily that, oh no, it's his story. I actually think it almost plays like an ensemble where it's like, we start with him. It really is his through line kind of that gives the movie its spine. But the other characters are so equally important that it's not super easy to just say, oh no, it's just this character's story and that's all we should be concerned with. You know, it's really all of them that make it work.
So something like a Sherlock Holmes or a Knives Out kind of scenario, which is a murder mystery. Or a mystery in general, it's generally the detective whose story it is, because we're seeing everything through their eyes, generally speaking. So Knives Out, it's Daniel Craig. We're walking through the whole movie through Daniel Craig's eyes, essentially.
I think so. I actually only saw that movie once, and I think I may have fallen asleep in the movie. Not because it wasn't good. I watched it late. But yeah, I think if the movie is sort of centered on an investigation,
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Almost always it's going to be the person doing the investigating, right? Because that's the sort of like through line of action that we're paying attention to. It's the reason this story exists is because there's something to investigate, and the person doing the investigation is who we're kind of like watching do the thing, and hopefully we're rooting for them, you know?
So like Clarice in Silence of the Lambs, it's all hers. It's her. It's definitely her story. No question about it.
I call it her story for sure. I don't know if anyone would disagree, but I think it's her.
But who you remember from that movie is not much, is Hannibal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you really remember their relationship. That's a movie that I, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, that was one that I really started studying. I was like, I want to understand how this one works. And I think prior to that, I had assumed that Clarice's sort of through line was really about Hannibal. And then when I rewatched it, you know, and this was like 3 or 4 years ago, whatever, but I started sort of watching it to study it a little bit more. And I realized, oh no, like she meets him early on, but then her investigation is her investigation. And then she brings him back into it again, but it's not his story at all. It's, you know, it's what he can do for her. It's him in support of her story, for sure.
It's fascinating to say. And another thing, when we were talking about structure and finding structures of movies that you know, studying other people's other movie structures and possibly using those structures in your own stories, I think a really good exercise is to analyze your top 10.
Mm.
Because it's, if it means something to you, if you are, and then you can start seeing the patterns. You're like, you know, if you like revenge movies, well, maybe you should write a revenge movie. If you like horror, maybe you should write a horror. If you love romance, you maybe want to write romance. As opposed to like, I really love horror, but I'm going to make When Harry Met Sally. I'm like, that's probably not going to work out.
Maybe. That could be a whole new rom-com there.
Jason Blum will produce it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I like that twist. No, I agree. And as an extension of that, I will say too, I think when you have a few like movie ideas under your belt, not that you have to have written the screenplays yet, but when you've like sort of, you know, practiced developing an idea, kind of teasing it out to see kind of what's there and maybe gotten to an outline stage, who knows? I also think it's really interesting and useful to sort of look at the common themes between those ideas, because I think a lot of times writers kind of circle the same thematic ideas in their projects without realizing it. And I see this sometimes, you know, not to embarrass anyone, but I see this sometimes because I work with certain writers over several projects and I'm like, oh, so this one is also about, you know, familial obligation, or this one
your
is
dad. It's right, about your
exactly.
dad.
Exactly. This one is also about, you know, that sort of that same issue that you find really interesting. And I think it's kind of funny that, you know, often writers don't even realize they're doing it. They're like, oh yeah, I guess I'm kind of writing the same story over again, you know, different concept, but dealing with the same issues or types of relationships or something like that. I think that's really interesting to examine because, you know, if you find that about yourself, if you're like, oh, I kind of keep going back to that same well, because that's an issue that's really interesting to me, then you can lean into that, right? That can become kind of part of your calling card, your voice, your portfolio, you know, that you put out there. So
yeah, I mean, it's your superpower. You're really starting to get that secret sauce that's yours.
Right.
And if you're passionate about, I mean, look, Nora Ephron, she really found her superpower, you know,
yeah.
And Quentin found his superpower and Aaron found that, like, you know, Shane Black, they all found that thing that they really resonate with and leaned into it, as opposed to, I mean, I'm sure a Shane Black romantic comedy would be extremely interesting.
Yes, I think it would be.
I think a Tarantino romantic comedy would be extremely interesting, but it's not something that they lean into.
Right.
You know, so that's something to think about as you're moving forward. Now, in your book, you also talk about the four elements, essential elements of a story foundation.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what those four elements are?
Yeah, I mean, I think they sound really basic, but they're something that every story needs, right? So you need your protagonist or your central character, however you want to think about that. Sometimes you might be dealing with an ensemble or a pair, but I just sort of, for default's sake, I call it a protagonist, right? That's number one, the story goal that they're trying to achieve over the course of the story, because the entire movie is based on the pursuit of that end point, right? That gives the story its structure. the opposition, or you can think of it as the antagonist, right? The main obstacle or main thing standing in your protagonist's way. And then the stakes. Why do they want to achieve this goal? Why is it important to them? What happens if they fail? There's some motivation there to keep them going, right?
All right. And then I always find out about everyone's always thinking about the hero's journey or the three act structure. Why is the three act structure the most popular, not four act or five act or seven act structure that, you know, some projects, especially plays, have? You know, why is it always the three act structure that everyone kind of leans into in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think by default, we talk about movies in three act structure. It's sort of become the common language of the industry, right? We sort of have all agreed that, like, this is sort of the framework for movies. You have three acts, you have a setup, an escalation, and a resolution. And that just is sort of, you know, the baseline. It's how most movies work. Not every movie. There are certainly exceptions to the rule, but mainstream movies kind of tend to have that structure, and they follow a particular rhythm and a pace that we're used to, right? And so those big turning points, those big structural plot points, the inciting incident, the break into act two, all of those create the pace of the movie. And that's why there's so much, you know, some people call them rules, right? Like, your inciting incident has to happen like page 12 or page 10 or between 10 and 15. I usually say between 10 and 15, but that's kind of why those rules are accepted sort of rules, right? Because if those big turning points happen kind of in a timely fashion where we expect them, that gives the story, that gives the movie the pacing that we're used to, right? It gives it that familiar rhythm, and it feels like things are happening on time and quickly enough that we're not getting bored, right? So to answer your question, though, I think that the three act structure is just sort of what we've all collectively agreed is kind of the lowest common denominator structure. And it gives you that setup, escalation, and resolution that we're all familiar with in stories, and that works so well with the length of feature films, you know?
So there's movies like, I remember, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, which has, from what I understand, five acts, but you can argue it has three acts. And a lot of three acts could be argued that have five acts, and you could start kind of breaking it down. And so is it kind of almost irrelevant to a certain extent, as long as you're hitting those beats? But a lot of these movies have different acts that don't line up exactly the way we want it to.
Yeah. And I would agree that it is largely irrelevant, because we don't have curtains on the movies that tell you when the act breaks happen. And so, you know what I mean? So this is all sort of like, again, I think remembering that this is all in an effort to have a particular effect on an audience. And that's why we concern ourselves with structure, right? Because we want our movies to feel like they have a particular pace and a particular, you know, shape that is somewhat familiar, but also surprising and takes us on an emotional journey and all of that stuff. So that's why we pay attention to structure. And that's not to say that every movie has to fall into three act structure. There are definitely movies that you could say have five acts, or sometimes people say they have four acts, right? Because you have act two split into two parts. I don't think it really matters, like you're saying. I think it's sort of irrelevant. It's how it feels, and is it delivering the effect on the audience that you want it to have? Basically, all of these like rules and tools and paradigms and things that we try to study and try to adhere to are in an effort to keep the audience from being bored and to keep the audience reinvesting in the story, right? So as long as you can do that, who cares how many acts you sat down to write it with? But all that said, I do think it's helpful for newer writers who are studying, you know, screenwriting and trying to figure out, how do I get this story idea out of my head and into a screenplay? I think it's useful for them to study three act structure and to understand, like, what is that effect that I'm trying to have on the audience at each turning point or at each particular section of the script. When I teach in some of my like first draft workshops, I use eight sequences. So you could look at those as being eight acts. You know what I mean?
I think what you're saying is just don't get caught up too much in it. But if you're starting out, it is the base. It is the foundation, the hero's journey, which is so famously, you know, brought to our attention by Mr. Joseph Campbell. is something that every writer, every storyteller needs to know. Whether they use it or not, I mean, it's very difficult to use the hero's journey in a detective story.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right.
It doesn't line up. But you should be able to know those things. These are basic understandings that you need to know as a screenwriter. And if you're going to make, and this is a frustration I've seen with a lot of screenwriters, is they'll write a screenplay and think they're very artistic. And then they try to submit it to Hollywood and it doesn't get any action. And they're like, why don't they recognize my genius? I go, because you haven't played by Hollywood's rules. But I don't care if you like it or not.
Right. It's,
I mean, every big movie that gets made, anything's made by a major studio has this kind of structure that we're talking about, has these turning points and point of no return. And it really does kind of follow the hero's journey if it's according to the genre that they're writing in. So you kind of, you know, fall into that. Now, once you build up and God forbid, have a career in the business of writing you've sold 3, 4, 5, 6 scripts and have produced a whole bunch of stuff and you want to start playing around.
Right.
Then you can start testing the waters because you have a name. If Quentin wants to come out and write whatever the hell he wants to, he could have someone reading a telephone book for 2 hours. Someone's going to go watch it. Because
right.
So if Sorkin or Shane Black or any of these great writers want to test the medium or push it, they've earned that right.
Right.
But you can't do that when you walk up.
Well, and also, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And also, like we were saying before, any of those writers that have really, you know, been kind of in the trenches for a long time and have ingrained that understanding of, well, here's why, you know, we say the inciting incident goes here, right? Here's the effect I'm trying to have on the audience. They know that that effect is really just about like grabbing our attention and letting us know the story is starting. So if they have another way to do that, that doesn't feel like a traditional inciting incident, you know, they have that sort of understanding of craft, whether they realize it or not, that they can kind of like do something interesting. And we go, oh, that works because I'm interested, you know, and that's the whole point is like, get your audience interested, kind of like, you know, get us emotionally invested and then keep us there as you tell us the story.
If you're walking into Hollywood and trying to get a job in Hollywood, I think living in that structured world to start is probably the best way to get in the door and to build and to build a career up. I'm not saying to be formulaic, but
right.
If everyone that's what's selling.
And also, writers have, you know, voiced that concern a lot. I think, you know, when you talk about structure, a lot of writers get worried that like, it's going to feel formulaic. It's going to feel like, you know exactly what's coming and you can expect everything. I don't think that's the case. It's like understanding that structure is a tool for the writer, right? It gives you a starting point, a jumping off point where you go, okay, so here's 3-act structure. I know kind of broad strokes. Here's where the setup happens. Here's where the escalation happens. Here's where the resolution happens. That doesn't mean that you have to have things occur in the most expected way or the way we've seen happen a million times before, right? That just gives you kind of the sandbox to play in. And then it's up to you to find interesting ways to convey the information that we need in order to follow your story, you know?
And I was watching a movie the other day and I can't remember because I watched so much content. It's hard to keep it all together in my head. But I remember I was sitting there with my wife watching a movie one night and it was good and we were really intrigued with it. And then at the end where it was like that the all is lost moment in the screen, which is towards the end of the second act going into the third act, we didn't see it coming. We knew that moment was going to come, but how it came was oh, the mother's the killer? What? Like it was just like, because the writer and the director did such a good job, you know, throwing red herrings out all over the place that you just, it just came out of nowhere, but in a really good way. So there is always ways to surprise an audience, but it's still going to happen around that time. Now, how it happens is up to you.
Right. Yeah. And I love it when a movie can do that, right? When it doesn't feel expected or formulaic or like I've seen it before.
I mean, let's go back. And this is a spoiler alert. Sixth Sense. If you haven't seen it, it's on you. One of the greatest twists in movie history.
Yeah.
Happened at a structural point. It happened exactly where it was supposed to happen, but boy, did no one saw that coming. Like no one saw it coming, but it still happened at the point where you're just like, oh, that's the point where it was that turning point had to happen. Like the way he did it was just like, holy cow.
I mean, and it all comes down to the effect on the audience, right? Because it was like that, the audience had been led to a point where that reveal had the most impact. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we're always talking about when it comes to structure.
Well, and if you look at the movie like Psycho, mm-hmm. I mean, let's look at that structure for a second. You know, again, spoiler alert, 1960, sorry. But when she dies, when Norman kills her in the shower, that's the beginning of the second act. But what's so brilliant about that script is now you're like, but okay, whose story? Oh, wait a minute. They swapped out protagonists.
Yeah.
Which was so brilliant. You're just like, and you killed off the movie star in the first 15 minutes. Like it was such a brilliant way, and no one had ever done anything like that before. But then again, where did it happen? The inciting incident. That's the inciting incident of the movie, essentially. Am I right?
I think so. Yeah. I haven't watched that movie in so long, but I would believe you if you said this is the inciting incident, because you know that you're trying to have a particular effect on the audience. And it's like, that makes sense for that to happen right there, because that shakes things up, right? It tells us that something is changing and the story is starting now because this just happened, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, we've been talking a lot about structure. Let's talk about character a little bit.
Yeah.
How do you develop an engaging main character? That's if you have any tips on that.
A good question. And I think there, you know, probably a million different ways. However, I do think it's useful to think about like what is sort of reverse engineer, right? And think about what are the ways that an audience or an individual person becomes engaged in a story, right? Because the story that we're watching comes through the protagonist character. We're watching one particular character story usually. So thinking about like what engages us. And a lot of times it's those like emotions that you know you can rely on to get somebody invested. So it's, you know, engaging our empathy for a character, showing us that they're someone that we should care about or you know, want to care about. And there's a reason to care about them. Engaging our sort of like tension or fear about what might happen for them, the anticipation that something bad might happen. So if you put a character in jeopardy, then we sort of lean in and we go, oh, this is a character I'm interested in following because I want to know what happens to them and I care about it. And then also, I think getting us to like a character, there's so much said about, you know, making your character likable. And I know that writers here hate to hear that your character has to be likable. And I'm not saying that at all, actually. But getting us to either like them or admire them or find them appealing in some way, I think is a really useful thing to think about that is so simple and so often overlooked, right? Like thinking about making your character appealing should be kind of a, you know, one of the early things that you think about, because if you think about this in terms of like, it's a product that you're trying to sell to someone, the movie is a product, right? There's got to be appealing selling points about it. And so hopefully your protagonist, your central character is one of those selling points, one of those appealing selling points. So thinking about like, can you make them funny? Can you make them good at what they do? Can you give them like unique talents or skills, or even sometimes just a unique personality that is engaging? Those are little tricks to kind of like hook our interest and start to get us to lean in.
I mean, and a movie in recent years that did this so beautifully was Joker.
I mean,
Joker, you literally, he's the villain. He's one of the great villains of all time, not only cinematic, but in literature. He's a really brilliantly written villain. And yet, how do you identify with a villain? And man, did they just structure that story and that character so beautiful. You feel the insanity of what it's like to be the Joker. And
totally.
And you're going through that, your journey with him. And at the end, you feel bad. Like, yeah, he's doing heinous stuff. But you're like, but I get it. Like, I understand where you're coming from. It's not just the twisting of the mustache, one dimension. It
right.
is layer upon layer upon layer upon layer with that movie.
Yeah.
That was so done so beautifully.
And if they had relied on you know, I think this does happen actually in a lot of sort of newer writer scripts where they go, well, this character is just fascinating because he's a character we love to hate, right? Like he's just an anti-hero and he just does terrible things and that's why he's fascinating.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And sometimes I think that might be able to work. Like I wouldn't say that it could never work, but if you think about it, the thing that made Joker such a compelling character, right, is that it played on our empathy. It that movie did such a, like you're saying, such a beautiful job of like showing us this character who isn't good, but there's so much that's in him that we can understand why he is the way he is, right? And I think it's human nature to have empathy for other people. So that movie does such a good job of playing on our own empathy, like as humans. And then also I think a little bit, it plays on kind of the same appeal that like true crime does. We mm-hmm. want to understand how this person got this way and what makes them do the things they do. So like the sort of dual, you know, qualities in people of empathy and curiosity, I think that movie like hit it on the head with that character.
And that they made his maniacal laugh an illness.
Yes, yeah.
Was a stroke of genius because yeah. that's the cartoony thing about the Joker. It's a comic book here, you know, yeah. character. But that they made it an actual illness. It's like, oh no, he's suffering when he's laughing. Oh, like, oh, so good.
Yeah, and it's such a good, you know, it just plays on us, right? Because the first time you're sort of like, oh, It's just like a real life experience where you might see somebody doing something that at first puts you on guard and you're like, oh, that's weird. I should be nervous. Right. But then if you learn there's actually something behind it, like they can't help it. It's a, you know, it's a disorder. It's a thing that they have to deal with. Then you suddenly start to feel bad about judging. And then, and you know, your empathy is sort of like rolled out for them. Yeah, exactly.
It's ramped up. It's like someone with Tourette's. You're like, oh, that's yeah. just a foul-mouthed person. And you're like, oh my God, she can't help it. Oh,
right. God.
So it's a completely, so they touched on that. Such a brilliant moment in that, yeah. in that character development. And, you know, speaking of villains, I think when you were saying that, you know, oh, he's an anti-hero. He's bad because he's fascinating to look at. That might've played in 1920. It doesn't play now. We're just too advanced for that. So even a movie like Endgame, Avengers Endgame, where Thanos, mm-hmm. who is, you know, the biggest, you know, bad guy at the time, he really, if you look at what he was trying to do, and same thing in Black Panther, if I remember the villain in that, they both had good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
They were just going about it the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, Thanos just wanted to depopulate the entire universe because we're running out of resources. And I saw it on my planet and I think I want to help everybody else. I'm just going to kill half. Right. So this is just a wrong way of going about it. But
yeah.
but it wasn't just like I'm bad to be bad and I just want to destroy the world. That doesn't play as much. It's too one-dimensional now, right?
Yeah, and Black Panther is a good example of that too. And I don't remember all of the specifics, but I do remember thinking that antagonist is it's almost difficult to decide who you should, you know, give your allegiance to because he was a guy who was reacting to the way he was brought up and he, you know, his background and the circumstances that he found himself in. And he had intentions too, that he was like, no, based on all of that, based on what I know and what I've experienced, here's what should happen. Right. And you kind of can't, that's what's so interesting about those characters is that you get to see what motivates them and understand where they're coming from. And then it's like, it's even more compelling to us, I think, as viewers, because we're like, ah, I don't want to agree with him, but I kind of see where he's coming from, you know, so.
and that's what keeps you engaged in a story. It's like you're following. That's why Black Panther was such a monster hit for many reasons. But that if that villain wasn't
right,
that it wouldn't have held the string of the story as well as it did. And, you know, we're talking about introductions of or talking about main characters. Introducing a character is something so important. And I just, when I was reading that in your book, I was like, oh, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
Not a word spoken. I think maybe one or two words that have nothing about his character, but that whole opening sequence all the way up until the boulder is about to crush him. Sorry, spoiler alert.
all spoilers this episode.
I mean, seriously, guys, I can't help it if you haven't seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. But the entire time. You find out so much about who Indiana Jones is within the first 5 to 10 minutes of that movie without a word spoken. It's really, it's fascinating. Well, I mean, Lance Kasdan is such a brilliant screenwriter.
Well, he's, writing movies. You know, I think that that's one thing that also is easy to overlook. Again, coming back to the idea that there are so many skill sets to remember when you're trying to write a good screenplay. One of them is, how do you introduce your protagonist in a way that conveys, you know, that gives us some information to go on? You want to, as quickly as possible, convey to us, who is this character and why should we be watching them, right? And that's an easily overlooked thing, because when you're juggling all those skill sets, you're like, okay, I got to get my protagonist in here somehow. And so, you know, very often we see he wakes up, he brushes his teeth, he goes to work. And, you know, sometimes that can give us valuable information about the character, but a lot of times that's just the first thing you thought of, right? So thinking about thinking about what could be a more, a more full introduction to your character, like a more, you know, interesting but also revealing introduction to them that can tell us more about them, just besides, you know, where they sleep and how they brush their teeth. I think the protagonist introduction is such a great place where, and again, talking about like not beating the creativity out of your story. By the time you get to writing your script, like coming up with that introduction, you don't want to have all these other things to think about, because you want to be able to take the time to like brainstorm, what's the most interesting way for me to introduce that character.
And when you were saying that, some like, oh, they got up and they brushed their teeth and they washed their face, first thing that popped into my head is Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets, which is an amazing character introduction, because again, not a word is said, but by his entire opening morning sequence, you learn like 90% of what you need to know about this character.
Yeah.
And the other 10% are kind of revealed beautifully throughout the rest of the script of its internal, but you just know so quickly who this person is. Tom Cruise in Rain Man.
Mm-hmm.
In the first 10 minutes, you know who this guy is so quickly.
Was it Bill Murray in What About Bob? Is that the one where he follows the toothbrush?
I think it might be. I haven't seen What About Bob in forever. But yeah, I think it might be. I mean, yeah, although, I mean, even him in Groundhog's Day, you kind of, you know, or even, no, even better, his introduction in Ghostbusters, when he's when he's doing the psychic test, but the way he does it, and he's being pervy, and he's, you know, all, you just know everything you need to know about Beckman. Like,
yeah, totally.
Really quickly.
What made me think about What About Bob is because we were talking about brushing the teeth. And I feel like that's, if I'm remembering right, that movie, he's like brushing his teeth, but he swallows the toothbrush. And it's like, of course that works, because that's not the traditional, he wakes up, he brushes his teeth, he goes to work. This is a guy who, like, you know, his default way of waking up and brushing his teeth is weird and tells us kind of that he's not normal, which was very important to know in that movie.
And I think it, as a good kind of way to an exercise that you should do as a screenwriter is to look at some of your favorite movies and see how they introduce those characters. Because as we're talking, like Tom Hanks and Turner and Hooch, when he was, doing everything, he's cleaning his nose hairs and like, you know, his whole house. Within the first 5 minutes, you know, this guy's a neat freak. And then, of course, Hooch comes into the and messes up his world. So it's all beautifully done. So if you start analyzing how these characters are introduced, that's a really helpful thing. Because I think in beginning scripts and bad scripts, characters are just like, they just show up and they're so one dimensional. Like, oh, look, he's got tattoos on and he had a suit on. Like, no, don't, you know, or hey, Bob, how's that job? Like they say it and they don't show it. And it's something that. It's something we need to fight against.
It is. It's an opportunity for you to be creative, right? It's an opportunity for you to like give us a scene that we're going to fall in love with. Both, we're going to fall in love with the movie, we're going to fall in love with your writing, we're going to fall in love with the character. So that protagonist introduction, you know, no pressure, but it's a really good opportunity for you to do something cool and interesting and compelling. So don't waste it, because you only have a certain number of pages for us to be engaged and to fall in love with what you're doing. So that's a big one.
Even Vin Diesel in Fast and Furious, when we're introduced to him, I mean, it's not super complex. It's not nearly as great an example as the other ones, but all you need to know about him is laid out in the first time you see him when he's racing and how he races and what he does. It's very important to his character.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And how he's introduced. So it's these kind of things that screenwriters need to think about with it. Because once you're hooked with the main character, if you do your job right, you're on the journey with them.
Yeah. And you know which one? I'll throw one more at you. Which character introduction I love is Aaron Brockovich.
Oh,
I know, because you immediately know who she is. I mean, it's a scene that could very well be a cliche because it's a job interview, right? Where she's being asked questions or she's answering questions. But it's an opportunity to give us a bunch of information right up front about who the character is, how she thinks, what her experience in the world is. And then right after that, you know, talk about like triggering our empathy. We see her T-boned by another car. You know, she's already like not great financially. She's looking for a job. She's struggling. And then this happens. And, you know, who doesn't have empathy for her after that?
I mean, she's the underdog. She's definitely the underdog. And you're like, but she's a fighter. And I'm like, hey, I'm an underdog. I'm a fighter. I'm going to go with her on this journey.
Right.
And that's how you go. Now, in your book, you also talk about a story chart. What is a story chart?
Well, I have a couple different story charts in the book. And, you know, they're really just like tools and exercises that I put together. Not just when I was writing the book, but with writers that I work with, to sort of try to help people get clear on the story they're telling, right? Because I think one of the instincts that newer writers have sometimes is like, I have an idea. Now I'm just going to sit down and write the whole thing. And it's like, there are a lot of steps that could help you get a grasp on what it is you're trying to write. Because not knowing what you're trying to write, I think, is a very quick way to get stuck and get writer's block and to abandon that project and never finish that screenplay. So I'm trying to help writers not get to that point. I want them to understand what they're trying to write and sort of develop their ideas in baby steps so that it doesn't feel hard, it doesn't feel overwhelming, and they get to the screenplay and can actually write the whole thing. So the story chart that I have in the book it's basically just taking kind of the broad strokes of a story. It's almost like the once upon a time, then this happened kind of template for a story, right? It's like that traditional sort of story that we all know and understand. It's sort of a version of that, just taking the broad strokes of a feature film, like here's kind of what happens in all the big sections, and laying it out in a chart so that you can use it as prompts to kind of figure out, okay, so in my story, in this broad stroke section, this is where we meet the character and understand, you know, kind of where they are in life right now. So you can then brainstorm and fill that in for your story. And kind of, again, it's a baby step. It's a way to kind of like start to get clear on what needs to happen in each section of your story.
And what's a springboard? I saw that. I'd love to hear what that is.
Yeah, that's, we were talking about the 8 sequences, right? So I teach, you know, getting through a first draft using springboards and sequences. It's one of the methods that I use to outline basically a way to figure out what happens in each part of your story. So the way I teach it is that, you know, a screenplay can be broken up into 8 sequences, and in between each sequence is a springboard. So it's a plot point. A lot of the springboards that you'll find are actually those major plot turning points, right? So the inciting incident is a springboard. The break into act 2 is a springboard. The midpoint is a springboard, the break into 3. So those kind of turning points are springboards for the next section of the script. So what happens at that plot point sends us in a particular direction that the next section of script plays out. And that's basically it. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Okay. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests.
Oh, sure.
What advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Interesting. Well, there's so much advice to be given, but I guess it depends on who I'm talking to in terms of where are they in the journey. But if they have written those screenplays that they're really proud of and are getting good feedback, and they just feel like they need to know some piece of information before they can like make that big break, right? I think my best advice is to not rely on one method. I always tell writers to have a lot of irons in the fire, to, you know, take a lot of different opportunities that come to them, because you just, you don't know which one is going to be the thing that sort of breaks you in. And more often than not, I think it's a snowball effect. It's like you get a yes here, and then you can leverage that to getting into this program. And then being in that program allows you to meet, you know, certain executives, and you can kind of like use those relationships to get your foot in the door in a writer's room or in, you know, something else. So I think it's a snowball effect. So you should say yes to things and sort of have as many irons in the fire as you can, because cumulatively, that's how you break in. It's not a lottery ticket. It's not one opportunity that's going to suddenly make your career and now you're in and you're never going to stop working and, you know, and all that stuff.
All the money just comes by trucks. I think they bring the money and they just pile the money, just goes into the front
yard.
Yeah,
that's what I've heard. I mean, I'm waiting, but
I've been waiting for quite some few decades at this point. I've been waiting for it.
Yeah.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Deep. So many questions. Wouldn't it have been funny if I had just recycled everything that I said last time I was
It's been such a long time. I would have been, that's a great answer.
I know. I have no idea what I said before. Well, I don't know if this is going to make sense, but I do think the lesson that probably took me the longest to learn and has so many different applications is know your audience, right? And I think that that's true when you're writing a script. You kind of have to have a sense of like, who is this for? Who is the audience for this? Who would go see this movie? Not because you're writing to the market or because you're pandering or catering just to one particular sensibility or something, but you do have to know that the thing that you're writing is meant to be seen. And so there is an audience who should want to see this, right? So I think knowing your audience comes in that sense. But then also, I think it applies to the sort of working collaborations that you're going to have as, you know, in any part of the filmmaking process. You know, you can speak differently to a fellow writer than you can to a director or your producer or, you know, whoever it is that you have to kind of do business with. And knowing the difference between a newer producer who doesn't really know what they're doing yet versus a very seasoned producer who, you know, you can speak with in a different way. I think knowing your audience is just so important in every regard.
Absolutely. Yeah. You start talking about big words and start throwing around screenwriting jargon to a young producer who doesn't know what they're doing. And if they have an ego problem, that's when fights start busting out or like these are things that they don't talk about. This is not stuff that it's taught at school. So knowing who you're talking to and knowing your audience is extremely important. Yeah, great answer. Great answer. Now, three screenplays that every screenwriter should read.
Okay. Well, I think my default answer would be choose the three screenplays that are most like things that you want to write, right? That are sort of like, if you could choose any screenplay to have written, choose those screenplays to study, because I think that that's probably going to help you the most, right? Because it'll speak directly to kind of like what you love about those stories. But if you're stuck and you're looking for suggestions, I think choose a, you know, I'll use this term loosely, but choose a classic, choose something pre-1980 to read just to kind of like see how stories were put together in an earlier time, in an earlier era. And then choose something that's been a, you know, say an Oscar winner for best screenplay in the last 20 years or something. And then choose something off of the blacklist to read, to get a sense of like, what are sort of current trends in screenwriting style? How are people doing things differently now than they were, you know, 40 years ago and 20 years ago?
Great advice. That's a great answer. I've never had that answer before on the show.
Oh,
that's
good.
A good, good answer to that question.
Something new.
And finally, your three favorite films of all time.
Oh, gosh. I'm sure that I answered this one before and probably regretted my answer immediately, because as soon as I say my favorites, I'm like, no, but what about this one? So classics that I just go back to again and again, and I love them because of the effect they have on me, but also because they're so interesting and offer so much to think about and study in terms of screenwriting. Silence of the Lambs, for sure. What other one do I always go back to? You know what I love about A Boy? I think that that's such an interesting screenplay and movie, and it does such a good job of, you know, we're talking about sort of like whose story is it and kind of balancing multiple characters. That's a good one to study if you are in that predicament of trying to have kind of a two-hander. And then let's see, third all-time favorite, you know, a recent favorite is Bridesmaids. I think that that movie does so much right and took me so much by surprise in terms of like how well put together that story is.
Very cool. And where can people pick up your book, The Screenplay Outline Workbook?
You can get it on Amazon. It's only in paperback at the moment. So it's a physical book that you get and you get to write in and do the exercises and hopefully, you know, develop your screenplay idea by the time you're finished with it. So yeah, Amazon's the place to see it.
Naomi, thank you so much for coming back on the show. You're welcome back anytime. I appreciate the good work you're doing to help some writers out there, you know, battle the problems of getting their first screenplay out there. So I appreciate you, my dear. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
I want to thank Naomi so much for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you so much, Naomi. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get her new book, The Screenplay Outline Workbook, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/236. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.